You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Hello. Few aspects of British life are changing as rapidly as the way we work. The trends are long-standing. A growth of service industries, a decline in manufacturing, outsourcing, agency working, self-employment, some of it voluntary, some not. And all of these are now commonplace. Large numbers of expensively educated graduates are now emerging from universities in debt and looking for well-paid work to pay off their student loans, only to complain of an economy seemingly filled with low-paid, low-skilled jobs. And yet, as the economy recovers, some employers are already complaining about skills shortages. So can the workplace deliver what Britain needs for future prosperity? And what are the prospects, particularly for young people in this increasingly fractured, fast-changing environment? What kind of career can be expected in this new British workplace? To help answer these questions, I'm joined by Francis O'Grady, the General Secretary of the TUC, Justin King, for 10 years, the Chief Executive of Sainsbury's, Alison Wolfe, Professor of Public Management at King's College London, who's long specialised in skills and training policy, and David Willetts, the Minister for Universities and Skills in the Coalition Government, and now the Executive Chair of the Resolution Foundation, a think tank that aims to improve living standards for people on low and middle incomes. Welcome to you all. And just before we get going, can I ask something about yourselves? What your first job was, and what, if anything, was the single most important thing you learned from it? What about you, Justin?
Well, I've started out in paper rounds when I was 12. I did paper rounds all through my school years.
And you learned?
To pay for the extras. Well, I learned turning up on time was important because newspaper goes out of date pretty sharpish, but also that being doing the job well, being nice to the customer worked. You got great tips at Christmas.
And Alison?
My first real job was counting the takings in a local store, and I had to get it to balance, and I counted it up, and it was mostly cash, and I walked down to the bank without anybody to escort me, I have to say, and it taught me to be very careful with numbers.
And Frances O'Grady, what was yours first?
I was an early two jobber. I worked weekends in a newsagent. I wasn't just in supervisor, but I could have been. And in the evenings, I worked in an Oxford college as a kitchen assistant, and I guess from the newsagent, I learned a lot from reading the newspapers, and as a kitchen assistant, I learned to join a union.
And David Willetts there in Portsmouth.
My first paid job was in my gap year. I left school and I had 9 months before I went off to university. I worked in a factory in Birmingham. I did the things like cleaning all the equipment during the industrial summer break that they used to have then in Birmingham in the 1970s. And I did a lot of furniture moving. And what I learnt was that even when you're faced with a big filing cabinet or a big desk, you'd be surprised how with a bit of human ingenuity you can get it out of the room and onto the truck.
But coming to the here and now, can we start with an issue we kept coming across in our series, low pay? As we reported last week, the Chartered Institute of Personnel Development reckons we've got the largest proportion of low-paid jobs of any advanced country except Spain. Justin, why do you think it is that Britain seems to stand out in this way?
I kind of reject the idea that it's low pay. It's lower pay. And it seems to me the most important words in that question are paid work. And the fact that we create a lot of paid work is part of the strength of this economy. We are a service economy, and therefore service economies are going to have good retailing sectors. Ours is pretty good, grocery and other retailing sector. It's going to be developing jobs, as we're seeing more widely across the economy in recent years, much better than our European competitors. And the idea that the consequence of that leads us to have a lot more lower paid jobs is a bad thing. I reject.
It's just a fact of life.
It's a fact of life. If you want to have the vast majority of people in gainful employment, you are always going to have some jobs that pay lower than others.
David Willetts, do you think there's any easy answer to this with your new hat as the Resolution Foundation on?
Well, Britain does have slightly more jobs that are low paid than other advanced economies. On the other hand, we have more employment in total, and it doesn't look as if there is a deterioration. If anything, the increase in the number of hours worked are in the more demanding, more skilled jobs.
So if there is a low paid jobs problem, you say it's one that's going away?
I would say it's not deteriorating, but we've got to do more about it.
Francis O'Grady, is this to some extent a failure of the trade unions and that you've not been able to organise the workers enough to be able to get wages up?
That's certainly one issue, but I don't think it's all the trade union's fault. We've got long-running problems in Britain of low productivity and low investment. And whilst, of course, some may say, well, there will always be lower paid jobs, the real question is, why is Britain's performance so much worse than other countries? And I think there has been a structural shift in the labour market away from some of those higher skilled, higher paid, high value jobs. The question is, I think, for a government, how do we incentivise investment? How do we tackle Britain's low productivity problem? And if we know that strong unions are part of the solution to low pay, and not just low pay, but unequal pay, then what are we doing to ensure that unions flourish?
What sort of difference do you think the Chancellor's new living wage might make to all of this, the £7.20 an hour for people over 25 from next April? If employers are required to pay more, are they going to have to make workers more productive, the sort of things you're thinking of?
Well, certainly raising wages can provide an incentive to invest and improve our productivity, because as long as labour is cheap, that incentive isn't there. But of course, the Chancellor's so-called living wage is actually a national minimum wage supplement. It's not a real living wage, as most people understand.
But it's higher than the minimum wage.
But it also excludes under 25-year-olds. And the real risk here is that we see those employers who want to keep their labour costs low substituting young, low-paid workers for adult workers who they would have to pay more. So if we're going to improve pay, we have to do it across the board.
What do you think, Justin King, about this? I mean, how would it affect large companies like Sainsbury's?
It will destroy jobs, no doubt about that.
Why?
At all. Because you can't talk about productivity without recognising that one of the consequences of productivity is less people involved in producing the same output. That is, therefore, less jobs. So if you end up with a wage for over 25s mandated £1 or £1.50 an hour more than perhaps the Low Pay Commission would have done in 5 years' time, that's the extension of what the government have talked about, then effectively you've got a figure that's maybe 10 or 15% higher than it would otherwise have been. And companies will invest in more productivity. That's less jobs. And as a consequence, therefore, there will be less jobs both domestically, but also, of course, it affects our competitiveness internationally too.
David Willetts, do you think the picture is, as Justin King paints it, that this living wage is going to mean fewer jobs?
Well, look, when I was a party politician, my party, the Conservative Party, warned that Labour's minimum wage would cost millions of jobs, and it didn't happen like that, and that's led to a rethink. There are, of course, at the margin, the risks that Justin describes, but overall, I think the Chancellor has judged this pretty carefully. It's coming in at a level which I don't think will do significant damage to jobs. And if one thing that happens is what Francis described, where there's a bit of a shift in employment towards the under-25s who are not covered by it, then I, for one, would think that would be a good thing, not a bad thing.
Alison Wood, from the point of view of employers, what they're seeing is the higher wage they've got to pay. Is that going to cost jobs?
Well, of course it is. Now, if the economy is growing, we won't notice, because you can then be in this happy situation where you can put the minimum wage up and there will be enough profit and profitability and indeed productivity in the economy that nobody will notice. But one of the things that was very interesting to me in this whole series that you've just run is how responsive to financial incentives everybody is. That, you know, the costs of employing somebody as opposed to having somebody who is self-employed working for you on a contract comes up time and time again. Individuals decide that it makes more sense for them to be self-employed than otherwise. Now, it's not always the case. Sometimes people are pushed into it. But, you know, for example, if I take Justin's old company, if I take Sainsbury's, every time they force me to do my own checkout, which I hate doing, by the way, I'm sure their productivity increases and there are fewer people on the checkout tills, which is absolutely logical. And I do think that one of our major challenges is how we actually work out in an economy where the biggest growing demand is for things where it's not obvious how you get more productive, like care homes and childcare. How do we actually cope with an economy in which that's where the huge demand for jobs is, but which it's not clear with, maybe David has some wonderful ideas, but I don't know how you make childcare seriously more productive.
Can we move on to the skills question here? I mean, there is a real conundrum. As we again reported, the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development said that we've got more people in Britain overqualified for the jobs they're doing than almost any other industrial country. And yet, once again, as seems to happen after every recession, employers' organisations are complaining we can't get the people they need to grow their businesses. So there are well-paid jobs here, which potentially could be filled by Brits. David Willetts, you were Minister for Universities. Why isn't the system delivering?
I am fundamentally an optimist about this. I think that economies will require more and more of these high-skilled jobs. And the evidence of the past decades is that as Britain has produced more and more graduates, by and large, they have been absorbed into more and more high-skilled jobs. And the so-called graduate premium, the extra you get for having gone to university, has remained pretty high. And some
well,
of
so
this...
it doesn't matter that so many graduates are working in jobs which...
A lot of this evidence is quite seriously misleading. The fact is that graduates often start in jobs where they say, oh, this isn't using my full graduate qualification. But if you then track them over the years and the decades, it is having a booster rocket behind your career.
So, Alison, do you think David is right? The more graduates, the better, that they will produce higher skills, higher wages?
No, I don't. I actually think that in any foreseeable economy, we have actually got to the point where there is an increasing proportion of graduates doing jobs which in the past were done perfectly well by people who had secondary education, and those people are now frozen out of them. I'm all in favour of people going to university because I've never met anybody who wished they were less educated. But I get deeply uneasy when the only purpose of university is seen as providing skills. And one of the reasons that we come out as looking so we have more underemployed or overskilled people is actually just because we already have a very, very high proportion of graduates in developed country terms. I have real worries about it because I think it diverts resources and people from the sort of intermediate technical skills, which may be fewer in number than they used to be, but which are still tremendously important.
Justin King, did you experience these skill shortages when you were at Sainsbury's? I mean, was that something that kept you awake at night?
Yeah, I mean, there are very significant skill shortages in the food industry. If you look at the total supply chain, in fact, the food industry, through an organisation called the IGD, the Institute of Grocery Distribution, have been running a campaign for several years called Feeding Britain's Future, which is trying to tell the story to younger people before they make their undergraduate choices of the great opportunities that lie in the food industry. I think education is a good thing, not just for employability, but we also need to be clear that more education needs to be focused, I think, on employability. And too often the choices our young people make, they only find out with the wrong choices for their future employment opportunity, too late to change them. The idea that 350,000 or so people can graduate all pretty much inside a month, that's roughly the cohort that comes through our universities, and immediately go into employment that is both in line with the general idea that they're a graduate, but also the specific skills that they might have is ludicrous. Of course, it's going to take time for the economy to absorb that. But I think industry needs to take much more responsibility for sending clear messages to government and to the education system about the skills that they need. I really don't buy this sort of constant whinging of industry that you hear time and again about not having the right skills produced, when often if you challenge back and say, well, what are you doing to make sure that those skills are created? Often there's some pretty blank faces.
One of the things people are doing, of course, to use their skills may be to become self-employed. And we reported in the series on the remarkable rise in the number of self-employed in the United Kingdom. It's a bigger rise here than any comparable country, we're told. And though on average the self-employed earn less than employed workers, they do seem, by and large, to be happier being self-employed. But the one thing that kept coming through is how disadvantaged they are relative to employed workers in terms of sickness pay, maternity pay, holiday pay, pensions, all these kind of things. And there seems to be a general agreement that something needs to be done. But what and who should be paying for it? I mean, Alison, what's your view on that?
We talk about self-employment as something new. There used to be something called casual labour, you know, and it wasn't great. There was a great deal of, quote, self-employment in the past.
But what are we going to do about this problem that they haven't got any of these rights that employed people do? There's this big difference. Does it matter?
Well, I think it does matter. And I think that the answer is not simply to say to anybody who uses that form of employment that, you know, they've got to give all the rights to anybody who's on a contract. I think this is actually something where future governments have got to take a role, that there is really a moral duty on central government to provide a framework for people who are self-employed, to give them... It's not simply about money, it's actually about structures, about paying in, about being able to set up things for yourself easily. I mean, I don't know about anybody else in this discussion, but pensions give me a headache every time I think about them. And it's very easy to let things slip when you're self-employed because nobody's doing it.
Frances O'Grady, what's your view on that?
I think our first priority has to be to tackle the casualisation that I'm afraid is still very much a feature of the British labour market and all too apparent in many so-called self-employed jobs. If people want to be their own boss, that's great, but huge numbers... You go to a construction site, on average, half of them will be self-employed. And I can tell you an awful lot of them are bogus self-employed, not getting any sick pay, holiday pay or any basic provision at all or rights, and would prefer to be on a stable, secure employment contract. Now, that's not just construction nowadays. That's further education. It's all sorts of areas where we're seeing not just self-employment, bogus self-employment, but zero hours contracts and agency work spreading.
Has the trade union movement missed a trick here? I mean, is this somewhere where among the self-employed and these people, you should have been doing more organising?
Well, we do have self-employed members, and part of our job for the genuine self-employed is to give real guidance on what you should be asking for, what your rate should be, how you do provide for old age and so on. But I think we need to be honest about the problem that Britain is facing. Not every self-employed person is the next Bill Gates. The average wage for a self-employed woman in Britain is less than £10,000 a year.
Justin King, what's your view on this? These people who are off the books because the employer really wants to avoid the costs of employing them?
Well, I think in a way this is where the conversation we've been having, the rubber of that conversation hits the road. You know, if you mandate that companies pay people a figure that's not economically justified by raising the national minimum wage for over 25s, if you then tax companies a training levy, it's just a piece of branding for a new tax, which only certain companies will have to pay. You can't then be surprised that some corporations develop business models to give them competitive advantage by avoiding those burdens, by avoiding having to pay an uneconomic minimum wage, by avoiding taxes and burdens that government keeps putting on them. One of the things you are going to see in this environment that we've been discussing is more companies looking at whether what we would probably agree, Frances and I, are actually bad employment practices, putting people beyond the benefits that they would get being employed by better companies. Some companies pay for breaks. Other companies do not. They pay only the hours worked. Companies that pay for breaks will get no credit for that in the new national minimum wage. So you're going to see a very significant move away from paid breaks for companies to be able to quote higher headline payment figures to meet this new uneconomic challenge.
But isn't that precisely the argument for having not just strong rights, but enforcing them so that the good employer isn't undercut by the bad? I mean, that's what we learned from the introduction of the national minimum wage. But what we need now is real investment in proper enforcement. We haven't got enough wages inspectors out there cracking down on those cowboy employers who are undermining the good ones.
Yes, but it's not about, of course, we should catch companies that don't pay the minimum wage. But these are companies that are through different employment systems. You talked about one, 0 hours contracts, those kind of things, are able to avoid those responsibilities. An umbrella company puts the ultimate employees of the company beyond the umbrella of the company that ultimately is paying for their work. So,
but our rights system needs to catch up with the reality of the 21st century labour market.
Well, it needs to keep step with changes that are, I understand, headline grabbing, but actually are going to bring about unintended consequences. And a mandated minimum wage that is not economically justified is going to accelerate those changes.